From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Louisiana's waterways took another hit Monday night after the U.S. Coast Guard announced an unknown amount of crude oil was spilled into Bayou Teche, a 125-mile waterway winding through the south-central part of the state. Residents were told to take shelter where they were as cleanup and environmental crews responded to the incident. The spill occurred while a tanker was being filled with oil. According to the Coast Guard, the source of the spill has since been secured. It was unclear how much crude oil was spilled, and an investigation was underway. Rescue crews deployed more than 200 yards of boom to contain the oil slick, and a wide stretch of the waterway was set to be closed to commercial vessel traffic until further notice. Louisiana was one of several states affected by the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, considered to be the largest accidental marine oil spill in the history of the petroleum industry and one of the worst environmental disasters in human history. Meanwhile, the environment in Ukraine has apparently become toxic since the 2014 U.S.-directed coup that drove elected President Viktor Yanukovych from office. Toxic, that is, for defense lawyers. Press TV's Lena Savchuk has more.
The Ukrainian attorneys raise alarm that their job is becoming dangerous for them. Cases of murders, criminal prosecution, threats, property damage, and searches in offices have been listed and documented in the new report of Ukrainian National Bar Association.
It is very difficult to work in these conditions. Now the prosecutor's office and police are reformed, and the consequences of those changes startle us because they show a tendency for increasing human rights violations via the prism of crackdown on attorneys.
The report comes after apparent homicide of Yuri Grabovsky, a lawyer of captured Russian Alexander Alexandro. While questions remain about who killed the attorney, few doubt that the murder was linked to his job.
I think that even if the chief military prosecutor Anatoly Matyush took time to hold a press conference and demonstrate that Grabovsky's murder was connected with his professional activities, there cannot be speculations about the opposite.
Attorneys say that, ironically, most of rights abuses are coming from law enforcement officials who are encouraged by their impunity.
This is investigators, prosecutor offices, who doing illegal seize of our offices, who illegally taking criminal procedure actions against lawyers, such as they invited them to be interviewed against the law. They have no right to do that because we have attorney-client privilege, which is protected by the law.
The UN obliges governments to protect lawyers, ensure their confidentiality and freedom from prosecution for their work. Ukrainian attorneys at law say that repressions against them have been on the rise since mid-2013, and Grabovsky's murder is only the tip of the iceberg. They complain that they do not feel safe protecting their clients and ask authorities to stop ignoring their concerns. Lena Savchuk, Press TV, Kiev.
People took to the streets in Tokyo. Thousands of protesters rallied outside Japan's parliament Tuesday as Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's new security law took effect, which allows the country's military to engage in action overseas for the first time since the end of the Second World War, when a pacifist constitution was adopted, banning the use of force as a means by which to settle international disputes. Opposition parties claim the law is a violation of the Constitution, and they say they plan a campaign for the legislation to be repealed in an upper house election scheduled for July. The Prime Minister said the changes strengthen Japan's ability to defend itself amid what he described as increasing threats. Legislators passed the bills into law in September with the support of the Obama administration. The shift could see Japan's troops fight abroad for the first time since the end of World War II. The lives of millions of children in Yemen have been devastated. That, according to the UN Children's Fund, or UNICEF, Tuesday. The country has faced a year of intensive aerial bombings led by Saudi Arabia with the support of the U.S. that has devastated the water, sewer, medical, electrical, and food supply infrastructure. UNICEF said that nearly 10 million youngsters are now in need of urgent humanitarian help. Since the bombing began a year ago, more than 900 children have been killed and some 1,300 injured, according to the latest UN figures, nearly seven times higher than the year prior to the bombing, that according to UNICEF's Julian Harnais, who, speaking from Yemen's capital, said this.
What continues every day is the shocking toll on children across the country.
Daniel Johnson has more.
Beyond the direct impact of war, UNICEF estimates that nearly 10,000 children under 5 years old have died from preventable diseases in the past year. This is partly because their parents have been too afraid to seek professional help amid continuing airstrikes on homes, markets, water systems, schools and health centers. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
U.S. President Barack Obama finished up last week's trip to Latin America with a stop in Argentina, which was seen by many as intended to support the country's newly elected right-wing president, Mauricio Macri. Macri was elected last November by a narrow margin over Daniel Scioli, who had the support of outgoing President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. After taking office on December 10th, Macri took advantage of the fact that the country's Congress would be in recess until early this month, using the power of presidential decree to inflate the currency, lay off many thousands of public sector workers, settle billions of dollars in claims with private vulture fund creditors, and most recently, pull Argentina out of the regional public media project known as Telesur. The two presidents held a joint press conference in Buenos Aires Thursday.
First, for Argentina, Liliana Franco from Ambito Financiero newspaper will ask a question.
Make my questions in Spanish because I'm in Argentina, sorry. La primera pregunta es para ambos presidentes.
The first question I'd like to ask of both presidents. Did you talk about a free trade agreement between the United States and Mercosur? And for President Obama in particular, what is the role you assigned to President Macri, especially considering the serious situation Brazil is currently going through? And how do you view the current negotiation between Argentina and the holdouts, or the way we call them here, the vulture funds? Thank you very much.
Bueno, hemos comenzado a plantear caminos de apertura.
So we have begun to look at ways to open up both agendas. This is a road that is now starting, and I told President Obama that we are exporting less than 1% of our agri-industrial exports, which means that there is a lot of room for growth as part of a path on which we must first consolidate Mercosur and then think about a broader free trade agreement. But clearly, what we both feel is that we have enormous room for joint work after many years of almost non-existent relations. A lot of opportunities are opening up, always with the same goal in mind, which is to create work for the Argentines and the Americans.
As I said in my initial statement, we have been enormously impressed by the work that President Macri has already done in his first 100 days. And we see good relations with all the countries in the hemisphere, but obviously Argentina, historically, as one of the most powerful, largest countries in the hemisphere, needs to be a critical partner with us in order for us to not only help our own people, but also to help promote prosperity and peace and opportunity in the region as a whole. I am absolutely confident that given President Macri's interest in transparency, accountability, economic reform here in Argentina, that he's setting an example for other countries in the hemisphere. And his engagement and willingness to have frank and constructive relations and conversations with the world community on critical multilateral issues like climate change, I think promises to heighten Argentina's influence on the world stage in settings like the G20. So I am saddened that I'm only going to have 9 months of overlap with him. He's at the beginning of his administration. I'm coming to the end of mine. But what we can do is to start on an effective path that I think will sustain itself into the future. Trade is an example of an area where we've already organized a working group between our delegations. They're going to identify all the areas where currently there are barriers that have impeded progress in our trading relationship, and we will systematically work through those. You know, organizing an entire free trade agreement maybe at the end of the process. I think at the beginning, right now, there's a lot of underbrush, a lot of unnecessary trade irritants and commercial irritants that can be cleared away administratively, and that's some of the work that we intend to do right away. Was there a second part of the question?
Hold out, how you see.
Oh. So, with respect to the holdouts and the bondholders, this is working its way through the court system, and I know that President Macri has also initiated a proposal that's being considered by your parliament. I have to be careful not to comment on the issue because of the nature of our legal system. These are judges typically that I appoint, and so in order for them to remain impartial, if there's a pending case, I do not talk about it publicly. What I can say is that the constructive approach that President Macri has taken, I think, has opened up the possibility of a resolution. And a resolution on this issue will stabilize Argentina's financial relationship internationally in a way that can accelerate many of the other issues that are of great concern. To some degree, this is viewed as high finance, and so ordinary people say, why does this matter? But if you're talking about foreign investment, if you're talking about trade, if you're talking about all the things that ultimately matter to ordinary people because they produce jobs and they produce economic development and provide more revenue in order to reinvest in education or science and technology, that requires the kind of financial stability that is so important. And look, I've been through this. When I came into office in 2008, the world financial system was going down the toilet, as we say. We had to take a lot of efforts and make difficult choices, and they weren't always popular at the time. But because of the steps that we took, our banks recovered faster than European banks, for example. Our economy began to recover faster. We started producing more jobs. So sometimes short-term pain and taking decisive action early is the right thing to do, rather than putting it off to mañana, and then you end up having a perpetual set of problems, and you never restore the kind of stability and trust that's necessary.
Thank you. Seguidamente, preguntar a Martín Di Natale.
Next, a question from Martín Di Natale, La Nación newspaper.
In Spanish.
We would like to ask you what you think is or was the role of the United States during the dictatorships that the region experienced, and whether you think there should be some self-criticism on the part of the United States with regard to that role during the era of dictatorships. And I would like to ask both presidents whether you have discussed the Brazilian crisis during your meeting.
I have spent a lot of time, both before I was president and since I've been president, studying the history of U.S. foreign policy. And like the history of any country's foreign policy, there are moments of great success and glory, and there are moments that were counterproductive or contrary to what I believe America should stand for. And you know, I don't want to go through the list of every activity of the United States in Latin America over the last 100 years. I suspect everybody here knows that history at least as well as I do. What is true, though, is that in the 70s, the recognition that human rights, how we approached foreign policy, how we approached our diplomacy, was as important as fighting communism or whatever our long-term objective was, that became much more central to U.S. foreign policy in both Democratic and Republican administrations. That there was a growth and a maturation of how we approached our foreign policy relationships. And so, you know, if you look at how administrations thought about other countries back in the 30s or the 50s or the 60s, and you compare it to how we would have a conversation in the Oval Office today, and what we would think was appropriate and what we think was not appropriate, that has changed over time. And I think it's changed in a positive way. And I think one of the great things about America, and I said this in Cuba, is we actually engage in a lot of self-criticism. There is no shortage of self-criticism in the United States. Certainly no shortage of criticism of its president, or its government, or its foreign policy. And there are issues that I work on where I'm sometimes criticized from the left and the right at the same time. Although for different reasons. The one thing that I will say is true, though, is that everything we do today is designed to take into account transparency, human rights, to speak out on behalf of those issues, even where we don't feel that we can force changes. On a government, we're still going to speak out about them. So I made a historic trip to Havana, and I said, the people of Cuba have nothing to fear from me, but you should know what I really believe. I believe that democracy is better than a one-party or one-person dictatorship. I believe in freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, and that people shouldn't be arbitrarily detained. And I say the same thing when I'm in China or in Russia or with some of our allies in ways that are uncomfortable. And so I think that it has become a habit, and we have learned some of the lessons that we may not have fully learned at an earlier time. And I think our experiences with a country like Argentina helped us to develop that more mature and ultimately, I think, more successful approach to foreign policy.
Brazil.
In terms of Brazil, we didn't discuss it extensively other than the fact that we hope Brazil resolves its current political crisis in an effective way. It is a big country. It is a friend to both of our countries. The good news, and President Macri, I think, pointed this out, their democracy is sufficiently mature. Their systems of laws and structures, I think, are strong enough that this will get resolved in a way that allows Brazil ultimately to prosper and be the significant world leader that it is. We need a strong and effective Brazil for our own economies and for world peace.
Así es.
That's the way it is. That is what we discussed. We clearly are following this closely. based on the affection we feel for the Brazilian people, Brazil being our main strategic partner out into the world through Mercosur, but we're convinced that Brazil will come out of this process and crisis strengthened, and we hope this will be as soon as possible, because clearly whatever happens in Brazil also has an impact on what happens in our own country.
From Margaret Tolliff of Bloomberg News.
Thank you, Mr. President. President Obama, in the wake of the Brussels attacks, you obviously thought a lot about whether to go ahead and attend that baseball game yesterday in Cuba and to continue on to Argentina and complete this trip. But you're catching some flack for it from some political critics at home. And I'm wondering, would you walk us through why you decided that this was the correct course in terms of optics and message? What is that message? And finally, on the trip, it seems to me that both in Cuba and in Argentina, you are seeking to roll back some of the maybe overreach or interventionism of the Cold War era. Wondering now that you're here, whether that's shaping your views on intervention in Syria or and a plan B. And President Macri, President Obama believes that normalizing relations with Cuba will give the U.S. a lot more credibility and leverage around Latin America. I'm wondering if you also believe that's true, and will you both commit to attending the Olympics in Brazil no matter what happens with instability? Thank you.
Margaret, I addressed this issue a little bit at the baseball game when I was interviewed by ESPN, but let me reiterate it. Groups like ISIL can't destroy us. They can't defeat us. They don't produce anything. They're not an existential threat to us. They are vicious killers and murderers who've perverted one of the world's great religions, and their primary power, in addition to killing innocent lives, is to strike fear in our societies, to disrupt our societies. So that the effect cascades from an explosion or an attack by a semi-automatic rifle. And even as we are systematic and ruthless and focused in going after them, disrupting their networks, getting their leaders, rolling up their operations, it is very important for us to not respond with fear. As I said, that's hard to do because we see the impact in such an intimate way of the attacks that they make. But we defeat them in part by saying, you are not strong, you are weak. We send a message to those who might be inspired by them to say, you are not going to change our values of liberty and openness and the respect of all people. And I mentioned at the baseball game yesterday, one of my proudest moments as president was watching Boston respond after the Boston Marathon attack, because they taught America a lesson. They grieved. I was there for the memorial. We apprehended those who had carried this out. But a few days later, folks were out shopping. A few days later, people were in that baseball stadium and, you know, singing the national anthem. And Big Papi was saying what he felt about Boston strong, and how a terrorist attack was not going to change the basic spirit of that city. Well, at that moment, he spoke about what America is. And that is how we are going to defeat these terrorist groups. in part because we're going after them and taking strikes against them and arresting them and getting intelligence on them and cooperating with other countries. But a lot of it is also going to be to say, you do not have power over us. We are strong. Our values are right. You offer nothing except death. And so it's important for the U.S. president and the U.S. government to be able to work with people who are building and who are creating things and creating jobs and trying to solve major problems like climate change and setting up educational exchanges for young people who are going to create the next new great invention or scientific breakthrough that can cure diseases. We have to make sure that we lift up and stay focused as well on the things that are most important to us, because we're on the right side of history. And with respect to how my reading of our history in Latin America impacts Syria, I think it's apples and oranges. What I have been clear about is when it comes to defending the United States or its allies and our core interests, I will not hesitate to use military force where necessary. When it is, but how we do that is important. We don't just go ahead and blow something up just so that we can go back home and say we blew something up. That's not a foreign policy. That's not a military strategy. And I do think it is important for the President of the United States and the administration to think through what they're doing so that they can achieve the objectives that are the priorities of the American people. And I can tell you that how I spend my time is thinking through with our generals, with our military, with our best thinkers, how are we going to most effectively go after ISIL? How do we most effectively bring peace to Syria? We don't just throw some military action at it without having thought it through and making sure that it's effective.
Bueno.
Well, I will give you my opinion on President Obama's trip to Cuba. It would be the great progress in American terms, because doors have opened and tools have been given to those who want to choose again. And he, as President of the United States there, went without relinquishing any of the values we embrace in the United States and Argentina, the flag of freedom, the cause of freedom. In other words, it's about every Cuban being able to decide what they want to do in their own future. I think this step that has been taken enables and speeds up the discussion. And that's what we need for the Cuban youth who want more freedom to find more partners around the whole world. I see that very positively, and I think it'll be highly positive for the next few years, this relationship between the United States and Latin America as well.
I had to let it happen. I had to change. Couldn't stay all my life down at heel, looking out of the window, staying out of the sun. So I chose freedom, running around trying everything new, but nothing impressed me at all. I never expected it to. Don't cry for me, Argentina. The truth is I never left you. All through my wild days, my mad existence, I kept my promise.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.